to the late 1950s, early 60s, in sort of Cold War era thinking that you needed these kinds of provisions for highly technical, highly risky contractor work. All of these soldiers, all these veterans, when they signed and raised their right hands and swore to do what they undertook to do, understood that enemy combatants could blow them to pieces, destroy them. And they accepted those risks, but they never accepted the idea that a contractor working for profit could be the source of lifetime illness and death and doom. And so that's why we went to war here in court on that issue, and that continues. Now, though, if we succeed, what we manage to do is have the taxpayers in U.S. Treasury step up and take care of KBR here. Like I say, it's a cherry on top of their billions of dollars in contracting revenues.
The veterans themselves, I wonder if we could just get back to that for a second.
Sure.
The vice president for litigation over at KBR says there is not evidence, medical or scientific evidence, that these veterans actually got sick from their work at the Karmat Ali facility. Would you say that there is evidence?
I would be a little more polite and a little measured had KBR not met Larry Roberta and Rocky Bixby, to give a couple of Oregon examples. Mr. Roberta's on oxygen now, in addition to having his digestive tract destroyed by these chemicals. Mr. Bixby has respiratory problems that are significant. And they know this. They've seen the medical records. They've seen the evidence. The jury heard all of it and didn't hesitate to find that all of these 12 trial veterans had been injured. There have been deaths from cancer in the Indiana Guard, and these things are medically connected. Most of these people are also on VA disability as a result of. Now, the VA doesn't find people disabled if they can't establish a connection. So KBR is refusing to deal with reality, and they make all sorts of pronouncements. They pronounce this case frivolous and without merit, and the Oregon jury that heard the case kind of disagreed to the tune of $85 million, some frivolous lawsuit. After trial, there was a change in the law of personal jurisdiction announced by the Supreme Court. It was in a case unrelated to ours. It did not review any of the evidence in our case. It simply changed the rules under which you could sue in a particular state. And under that new ruling announced after this case went to trial, we could not maintain this lawsuit in Oregon.
So what's going to happen to the veterans now?
The Oregon veterans, the case will be rebooted. We're going to transfer it to Texas and start over. And as KBR knows, it's not over. I don't particularly know the specifics of indemnification rules, but it sure looks that in addition to that $30 million, there will be future costs and there will be claims by these veterans that, as I read this decision, will be charged to the Treasury. This is what happens when our government makes bad deals in secret on the eve of war.
Well, I do want to thank you so much for joining us. Again, I've been speaking with David Sugarman, one of the attorneys for a number of National Guard soldiers, as well as other soldiers who were impacted by working at the Karmat Ali facility in Iraq, suffered from the dangerous chemicals they were exposed to, and initially had a ruling in their favor for $85 million settlement and an $85 million judgment in their favor. Then that was thrown out on a technicality. Now taxpayers are being asked to shoulder the $30 million in legal fees by the company KBR. David Sugarman, thank you for joining us on KBOO.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
local opposition scuttled plans for a Trader Joe's grocery in northeast Portland, but another grocery chain has been given the go-ahead to purchase the same land. Natural Grocers, based in Colorado, plans to construct a two-building shopping complex at the corner of Northeast Alberta and Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. The Portland Development Commission, which oversees urban renewal projects in the city, gave the chain a thumbs up to purchase and develop the land, as well as a substantial subsidy. The subsidy, which exceeds $100,000, is in addition to a $2.4 million break on the price of the land, according to appraisers.
At today's Portland City Council meeting, the council approved an ordinance to help restore salmon in Tryon Creek. The ordinance authorizes an intergovernmental agreement with Metro. It also provides a grant in the amount of $650,000 for Boone's Ferry Fish, Wildlife, and Trail Passage Partnership Project. The Bureau of Environmental Services, or BES, called for changes to the culvert to allow salmon and other fish to pass. Jane Bakery of the Watershed Services Group testified in support of the plan.
A few facts about Tryon Creek. The Tryon Creek watershed is home to ESA-listed salmonid species, including steelhead trout, Chinook salmon, and coho salmon. It also provides habitat for other native fish, such as Pacific lamprey and Western brook lamprey, and also for wildlife, including black-tailed deer and North American beaver. The Tryon Creek is one of the five watershed management areas in the city of Portland. Its headwaters are near Mount Loma Village, and it flows into the Willamette River at Lake Oswego. Development in the headwaters and natural resource protection for the Tryon Creek State Natural Area are very important planning considerations when we consider projects in this area. BES's watershed health strategy includes stormwater controls in the upper watershed and in-stream restoration in the lower watershed. And the Boone's Ferry Culvert is in the white call-out box, sort of right in the middle of the watershed. The 140-foot-long culvert for Tryon Creek at Boone's Ferry Road was identified by BES and community partners as undersized and a major fish passage barrier in the 2005 FANO and Tryon Creek Watershed Plan. The culvert is a fish passage barrier due to the jump height for fish to enter the culvert. The culvert was further analyzed for the BES 2008 Capital Improvement Pre-Design Report, and the report noted that the culvert could feasibly be replaced by a larger open-bottom culvert with a natural stream bed or by a bridge. At that time in 2008, the community, and notably Southwest Trails, expressed interest in using the project to also bring a pedestrian trail under the Boone's Ferry Road at the site to complete the missing portion of the Hillsdale to Lake Oswego regional trail identified by Metro. And at that point, an alternative safe solution for pedestrian crossings at the busy Boone's Ferry Road area had eluded PBOT and also trail advocates.
That was testimony at this morning's Portland City Council meeting on a measure to expand support for salmon and other fish in Tryon Creek in southwest Portland.
According to statistics released by the insurance company Allstate, an average Portland driver has a crash every 7 years, while drivers in the rest of the country average a crash every 10 years. Out of 200 cities included in the study, Portland's was one of the worst, ranking 183rd. But Portlanders are still safer drivers than people in other big West Coast cities. Drivers in Seattle, San Francisco, and Los Angeles all rated worse in the study. Boston, Massachusetts finished last in the study, while Boise, Idaho was rated safest.
A coalition of organizations came together today at Portland's Human Rights Commission hearing to submit a proposal that the city of Portland divest from companies involved in Israel's military occupation. The coalition calls itself Occupation Free Portland and is made up of Christian, Muslim, Jewish, and secular organizations who are calling for equal rights for the Palestinian people and an end to the Israeli military occupation. For more, KBOO's Jenica Soderberg spoke with Ned Rosh of Jewish Voice for Peace, which is a member of Occupation Free Portland.
So, Ned, can you tell us about Occupation Free Portland and the proposal being presented today?
Sure. Occupation Free Portland is a coalition of organizations and individuals here locally in Portland, made up of Jews, Muslims, Christians, and many others of conscience and goodwill, who believe that promoting the time-honored, moral, nonviolent tactic of divestment is one way to promote human rights for Palestinians living under the brutal Israeli occupation of Palestinian land. So we'll be going to the Human Rights Commission today and asking them to sign a letter that we've drafted for them. And what this letter says is, well, first of all, I should back up and say that the city of Portland last year set up a socially responsible investment committee. And what that committee is charged with doing is advising the city how to invest city dollars, so our dollars, our tax dollars. And one of the criteria for investment is human rights. So we're encouraging the Human Rights Commission to sign a letter to the Socially Responsible Investment Committee saying that for companies that are involved in helping Israel maintain its occupation of Palestinian land and abusing Palestinians and violating human rights, and those four companies are profiting by that complicity with violations of human rights, that those four companies should be on a do not invest or do not buy list here in the city of Portland until they change their ways. Because we in the city of Portland, we don't want our dollars invested in, and I'll name those four companies, Caterpillar, G4S, Hewlett-Packard, and Motorola.
And can you talk a little bit about those companies?
Sure.
And how they're involved in the Israeli occupation of Palestine?
Sure. So Caterpillar sells militarized bulldozers to the Israeli occupation forces. And those bulldozers are used to demolish Palestinian homes. Of course, this is illegal. To uproot their orchards, their farms, and of course, that's illegal. These same bulldozers were involved in the killing. They ran over the peace activist from Olympia, Rachel Corrie, who was in Gaza defending a Palestinian home from demolition. And these same bulldozers were very active last year in Gaza in the Israeli invasion of Gaza. Often they send in the bulldozers to just flatten neighborhoods before the Israeli forces enter behind the bulldozers. G4S is very involved in the Israeli prison system, which abuses young children, which arrests people without warrant, which doesn't tell them why they're in prison, which denies them due process. So there are lots and lots of human rights violations involved in the prison system. Hewlett-Packard has a population registry of Palestinians that they've developed for the Israelis. They've developed ID cards that are analogous to the infamous passbooks of apartheid South Africa. And finally, Motorola, they're involved in setting up and maintaining electronic surveillance for the illegal Jewish settlements that are located on Palestinian land. And they provide telecommunication support to the military, the Israeli military, to maintain the occupation. So the human rights records of these four companies, it's pretty abysmal. And what's interesting is that church groups and others have been engaged with these companies in dialogue for many of these companies far more than a decade, asking them to change their ways, informing them of the fact that we citizens of the world know what they're doing and we really don't like it and we really would like them to become more responsible corporate citizens. And all four of these companies have changed not one ounce or one item of how they do business.
Last week at the Portland City Council meeting, there was an item about communications technology that is sourced from the Congo. There was a concern about conflict minerals, and the City Council decided that the city should divest from any companies that actually engage in the Congo or get their source material from the Congo. What similarities do you see between that decision by the City Council and what you're asking for with the boycott of these particular companies involved in the Israeli occupation?
Well, I think that's good news. I mean, I think that's very persuasive. And, you know, what we want to say to not only the Human Rights Commission and the Socially Responsible Investment Committee, and ultimately the City Council, is that human rights are human rights. And if we respect human rights anywhere, we need to respect them everywhere. I think that, you know, Dr. King was right when he said, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And if we are going to act in a way that, you know, resonates, where the words resonate with our actions and our actions resonate with the words, then if we are concerned about human rights violations in the Congo, we need to be equally concerned about human rights violations in Palestine.
What do you hope that the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement will accomplish?
Well, I think it's important to remember that the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement is in the tradition of Gandhi and King and Cesar Chavez and Tutu and the Montgomery bus boycott and the movement to bring down apartheid South Africa. And, you know, it is a tradition that has inspired millions of people around the world. And I think that what we're seeing is that in South Africa, whereas it took more than three decades for it to catch on in a big-time way, in the issue of Palestine, it's only been one decade that the call from Palestinian civil society for BDS has been out there, and already we're seeing massive victories. The hope is that this will continue to snowball and the pressure Israel feels will continue to grow. And as Israel has said itself, you know, we don't do Gandhi very well. They know how to fight militarily, but when we move this hopefully to a different battlefield, and that's the battlefield of morality, Israel's at a distinct disadvantage. And ultimately, you know, what we want is we want human rights and equality and dignity for all the peoples of the Middle East, and that certainly includes the Palestinians, who right now are suffering unimaginable levels of dispossession, ethnic cleansing, uprooting of orchards, demolition of homes, and denial of human rights.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us. Again, I've been speaking with Ned Roche. He's with Jewish Voice for Peace, as well as Occupation Free Portland, the group presented today at the Portland Human Rights Commission meeting, and are calling on the city of Portland to divest from four companies, Hewlett-Packard, G4S, Caterpillar, and Motorola, to call on those companies to stop their investment in the Israeli military occupation of Palestine. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Juan Kim regarding his upcoming concert. This will be followed by Treasures from the Archives at 6. At 7 p.m., it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Today in history, in 1945, on the deck of the USS Missouri in Tokyo Bay, representatives from the Empire of Japan and several Allied powers signed the Japanese Instrument of Surrender, formally ending World War II.
It is 5:26, time now for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Occasionally, I see something that is so bizarre, so out of place, so wrong, that I have to assume I'm hallucinating. For example, the National Park Service's Pullman National Monument in Chicago. George Pullman? My mind boggled. Our tax dollars are being spent to build a national park in tribute to a narcissistic, paternalistic, brutalistic 19th century robber baron. Yes, Pullman, a notorious union buster and exploiter of working families, is having his history mythologized by today's powers that be, portraying him as a model of the corporate order's historic virtue. At the February 19 official consecration of Pullman's park, Chicago's thoroughly corporatized mayor, Rahm Emanuel, even gushed, "This will be a monument to Pullman's role in building the American dream." Sure, Your Honor, Dream as in nightmare. Over 5,000 workers toiled in Pullman factories making rail cars, including the luxury Palace Sleeper for elite train travel. He condescendingly referred to these workers as his children. But what a dysfunctional father! In the hard winter of 1894, this feudal lord of the manor abruptly slashed his children's meager wages by some 25%, leaving many unable to pay rent and feed their families. Thus came the historic Pullman strike that quickly spread nationwide, led by the union icon Eugene Debs. No problem for Lord George, though. He and other railroad royals rushed to the White House and got President Grover Cleveland to dispatch the U.S. Army to crush the labor rebellion. 30 workers were killed, Debs was arrested on a trumped-up conspiracy charge, and all laborers who had joined the strike were fired and blacklisted. This is Jim Hightower saying, the only way that Pullman National Monument can have any legitimacy is to strew the grounds with sculptures of the 30 dead workers he killed.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Student groups at Portland State University are raising questions today about the business practices of the university's president, Vim Vivel. The website, GoLocalPDX, reports that Vivel, who is compensated around $600,000 a year, has been running a private consulting business out of the university-owned house where he lives. Vivel is technically operating within the letter of the law, but some feel that he is violating its spirit. Today, student leaders at PSU issued a call for Vivel to refund any profits he makes to the university. The students say that the president is acting irresponsibly. However, PSU officials say that Vivel has done nothing wrong and that running the business out of his house is a fairly run-of-the-mill activity. The official PSU spokesperson said that such activity was encouraged by the Board of Trustees because it raises the profile of the university. But student leaders who issued the call say his actions go against the spirit of openness, transparency, and access that Portland State University is supposed to represent.
Last weekend saw a record-breaking storm hit Portland, and many have spent the last few days picking up the pieces. The Portland Bureau of Transportation says it needs citizens' help in doing the same. Branches and other debris are threatening to clog storm drains as meteorologists predict rain for the next couple of days. PBOT spokesman Dylan Rivera says there are as many as 50,000 storm drains in the city, but only 350 workers to keep them clean. The city is asking residents to clean branches, pine cones, leaves, and needles out of storm drains to prevent flooding. He recommends using a rake or a pitchfork to move the debris into bins usually used for yard waste.
New college graduates and people changing careers might want to hone their resumes to include more detail about information technology and adaptability. Robert Half International's 2016 Salary Guide, which was released today, predicts major opportunities and higher pay in the next year, even for entry-level workers with IT skills. KBOO's Joseph Jordan has more in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
New mobile app developers, data engineers, and wireless networking engineers are all expected to get a major wage bump next year, says one of the world's largest recruiting firms. In its new 2016 salary guide out today, Robert Half International projects starting pay in IT fields to increase 5% next year. But too often, people sell themselves short in the hiring process, says Portland career coach Barbara Bard. Particularly in highly competitive fields, she says, pay for many of these positions isn't a fixed number.
Employers do expect some sort of negotiation with regards to salary. And, you know, it's important that they understand what I call their professional value of contribution in order to successfully navigate through that negotiation phase.
Bard's advice to job hunters is to research potential employers with an eye to how their specific strengths and skills will fit and can benefit that company, and then tailor their resume accordingly. The salary guide examines hiring and pay outlook for more than 700 positions and predicts higher pay for most. State data shows Oregon's unemployment rate has hovered near 5% this summer. Chris Jansen, with Robert Half International, expects continued job growth and says more companies are already investing in full-time workers.
For a college-degreed worker today that's over the age of 25, the unemployment rate is half the national average at 2.6%. In most instances, from an economic standpoint, that would be considered full employment.
He suggests the best resumes show an intermingling of skills from different disciplines. His company also surveys workers and found pay is the primary factor that motivates change. A bigger salary is what 83% said it would take to get them to jump into another job. But almost half, 46%, would go for more growth opportunities. Only 40% said better work-life balance. For KBOO News, I'm Joseph Jordan.
President Obama has just claimed a major victory as Barbara Mikulski became the 34th senator to declare support for the Iran deal, giving the White House enough votes to veto a Republican resolution to oppose the deal. The diplomatic deal with Iran focuses primarily on limiting Iran's ability to produce and control the fissile materials necessary to build a nuclear weapon. The terms of the deal include the reduction of Iran's stockpile of enriched uranium from 10,000 kilograms to just 300. Without this deal, Iran will not be subject to international inspection of its nuclear facilities. Robert Nyman of Just Foreign Policy spoke this morning on KBOO's Air Cascadia.
Any voting is expected to take place in mid-September, so we have at least a week. And I think this is key for people in Oregon to know, because one of your senators is supporting the deal. But your other, that's Merkley, yay Merkley, but Ron Wyden is listed as leaning no. So I hope that, this is great news that we reach 34, but I hope that no one in Oregon will let up any pressure on Wyden. On the contrary, I hope people will redouble pressure on Wyden, because there's a question here, not just, okay, now we know the deal is going to go through. But there's still a question of what kind of people do we want leading our country? What kind of people do we want leading the Democratic Party? This isn't the last time in human history that the U.S. is likely to face a choice between war and diplomacy. Chuck Schumer was one of two Senate Democrats against the deal. He voted for the Iraq War. So these people hang around and get to weigh in again. And so, you know, what kind of senators does Oregon want to have? Do you want to have Ron Wyden as your senator if he opposes the deal? Or conversely, do you want, you know, to pressure Ron Wyden to do the right thing so you have two Oregon Democratic senators supporting the deal? And the practical consequence of that going forward immediately is that if 41 Democratic senators stand up now we have 34. If 41 Democratic senators stand up and say, yes, we support the deal, then the Senate Republicans can't even pass their resolution of disapproval, and it never will get to President Obama's desk for him to veto it in the first place. And that would be a very decisive message to the world from the United States, that we think we really learned something important from the Iraq fiasco, and we're doing something differently now. And it'll be a message from the United States to itself. Maybe we won't have to go through rituals like this so much in the future, because the people won't take so seriously the warmongering faction. But they say, okay, well, yeah, there are those people, but when push came to shove, the American people and their representatives went the other way. So maybe we don't have to give these warmongering voices so much attention anymore.
That was Robert Nyman of Just Foreign Policy.
A judge in Maryland refused to dismiss a prosecutor in the case against six police officers accused of killing Freddie Gray. Gray, 25, sustained a spinal cord injury when the officers subdued and arrested him in West Baltimore in April. Gray died a week later from the injury, which fueled massive protests in the city. An attorney for the officers sought to have Marilyn Mosby, the state's attorney for Baltimore City, dismissed from the case for bias. Mosby held a press conference in May that attorneys for the officers said violated court rules, but Judge Barry Williams disagreed and allowed her to remain on the case. Next, Williams will decide if the officers will be tried individually or as a group.
Hundreds of thousands of refugees have arrived in Europe this year, fleeing civil war in the Middle East and totalitarianism in Central Asia. The countries of the European Union have struggled to know what to do with the flood of migrants, most of whom enter through the EU, through Greece and Italy, but end up in Germany. A 28-year-old man was arrested in Berlin yesterday after he attacked refugees with pepper spray. German Chancellor Angela Merkel condemned the attack and has called the refugee crisis a test of the EU's core value of universal human rights. But she's also called for other countries to take on more of the refugees. Germany has received more than 70,000 asylum applications. That is more than France, Italy, and the United Kingdom combined.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.immc.org for Wednesday, September 2nd, 2015. Israeli troops injured two Palestinians in separate attacks in the West Bank. Meanwhile, a settler injured a Palestinian shepherd. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. On Wednesday night, Israeli soldiers shot and injured a Palestinian teenager in the city of Bethlehem, southern West Bank. According to local sources, Israeli troops shot and injured Anan Melesh, 15, at the entrance of Aida refugee camp near the Israeli wall separating Bethlehem from Jerusalem. Troops stormed the camp and kidnapped Melesh after injuring him, a local media reported. Israeli troops claimed that the boy threw a cocktail Molotov bomb at them, a claim that was refused by local residents. Earlier on Wednesday, Israeli soldiers attacked and injured an elderly Palestinian woman and kidnapped eight shepherds and farmers in Salem village east of the northern West Bank city of Nablus. Medical sources in Nablus said that Mahfouza Ishtiya, 75 years of age, attempted to defend her son as Israeli soldiers were trying to kidnap him, then they violently assaulted her. The woman suffered various cuts and bruises and was moved to a local hospital in Nablus. The soldiers also attacked and kidnapped eight Palestinian shepherds in the area and took them to a number of detention and interrogation centers. In related news, a Palestinian shepherd was injured and eight of his sheep were killed after being rammed with a speeding settler car east of Yatta in the southern West Bank city of Hebron. The shepherd, Isa Abu Arram, suffered various cuts and bruises. The settler fled the scene, local sources reported. On Wednesday at dawn, Israeli soldiers invaded various Palestinian communities in different parts of the occupied West Bank and kidnapped at least seven Palestinians. Kidnappings were reported in the West Bank districts of Bethlehem, Hebron, Nablus, and Ramallah, Palestinian sources reported. Furthermore, a number of Israeli fanatics sabotaged the main power transformer providing Kfar Kaddoum village east of Qalqilya with electricity, causing a power blockade for several hours. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, September 2nd, 2015 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bambura.
A new report by NASA has found a near certainty that the world will experience at least 3 feet of sea level rise due to human-induced climate change. Some cities, regions, and countries have already taken action to identify inundation zones, which are coastal areas that will almost certainly be underwater in the coming decades. Sea levels have already risen 3 inches on average since 1992, with some areas experiencing as much as a 9-inch rise. According to the lead scientist on the NASA study, given what we know now about how the ocean expands as it warms and how ice sheets and glaciers are adding water to the seas, it's pretty certain that we are locked into at least 3 feet of sea level rise and probably more.
World leaders are meeting in Bonn, Germany this week to draft a carbon emissions reduction agreement in advance of a Paris conference later this year. There are only 10 negotiating days scheduled before December, when the Conference of Parties, or COP15, is scheduled for Paris. Negotiators say the situation is desperate as climate change threatens wide-scale destruction to many parts of the world. The Kyoto Protocol included mandatory emissions reductions, but the United States refuses to agree to mandatory carbon emission reductions. According to Robert Orr, a longtime advisor to the head of the United Nations, everyone agrees we need a pathway to a global temperature rise of 2 degrees Celsius at most. This will require changes in most countries' economies and infrastructure. Meanwhile, a campaign to urge fossil fuel divestment stepped up a notch today with the launch of a major conference in Paris. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Joseph Jordan, Jimmy Tardy, and Joel. The producer is Galen Sanford. Our engineers are Ian Westmoreland and Galen Sanford. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at kboonews. If you'd like to call your elected officials about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are their phone numbers. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. Senator Jeff Merkley, 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's phone number is 503-378-3111. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You're listening to KBOO in Portland at 90.7 FM. We're in Philomath at 104.3 FM and in Hood River at 91.9 FM. I'm Andrew Geller.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's a special KBOO Board Candidate Forum moderated by Dave Mazza. We'll hear from the four candidates for this year's elections: Shaheen Khalili, Timothy Welp, Gil Carden, and Kip Kruger. At 9 o'clock, it's Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know, with host Teresa Mitchell. At 9:30, Perfagrine hosts Fight the Empire, connecting history with the latest world events. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news.